Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Okay, welcome to the show, everyone. Today we're joined by James Gosling. James Gosling is engineering manager at McLaren Applied. It's great to have you join us today, James. It's great to see you again. I spoke with you the other week. So, yeah, thanks for taking the time to come on the show.
Thanks, Ben. And yeah, good to talk again.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, to say the very least, actually. Yeah. So let's get the ball rolling with this. So could you give us a bit of background on kind of your career journey and how you got to where you are today as engineering manager at McLaren Applied?
Yeah, sure. So I'd start very early days, and that I was a software engineer, sort of a degree, did a master's in Sheffield University, started to in the financial industry as a graduate engineer, sort of doing a sort of a graduate rotation, as often people do, and very early thought I was going to be very technical and interested in coding and so forth, but I was very lucky to come into a company, Fidelity, that were going through a bit of their own transformation at the time. Unbeknown to me, just before I joined, they had a bit of a lesson of how not to do things in terms of try the big bang approach, and it kind of failed, and they needed to do something different, which is quite common and a repeating story in the software industry. And I was lucky in the first couple of years that I was there to end up being on a project which was sort of an agile project, and very early learned that technical things are very interesting, but also how you run projects, how you run create products and so forth is very interesting. So I was lucky when I was very young and eager to come into a company, and I learned very early about not just technical coding, but also the different ways and the very futuristic way at that point in time of development. But after a couple of years of Fidelity, things came to an end, and I had to look somewhere else. And after looking at a few things, ended up throwing myself into consultancy. People telling me it was good and it opened my eyes. I didn't quite know what that meant at the time.
Yeah.
Then I joined a place known then at Datica, later bought out by BAE Systems as BAE Systems Applied Intelligence, where I ended up being an IT consultant, which was a very, very interesting, very useful place. I think, again, I didn't quite know what I was going into, but being a consultancy, you end up being in 101 different positions and places that you never knew you could do, and it really brought out my exposure to customers, tricky problems, and having to think on my feet. And again, a combination of technology and also helping people understand problems and solutions to those problems meant that, again, I increased my technical experience, but I also increased my knowledge of how to solve problems and identify those problems and find solutions, which, again, coming back to Fidelity, was a great thing in terms of understanding little steps go a long way, sort of thing. And through that, I started to get into a bit more into management and so forth, because I was there for quite a few years. And that sort of led me into scrum master roles and technical project manager roles and so forth, whilst continuing to do technical things. And then after being there for a good 7.5 years, decided to try something else. Didn't quite know what. Again, looked around, saw what there was, saw a few opportunities, and then ended up going to Accenture Digital, which I never thought I'd end up at Accenture. So they're similar to Datica, but a lot bigger. And I had this perception of them doing sort of cookie cutter stuff, where big rollouts of solutions, existing solutions, and so forth. But Accenture Digital were a slightly different way of looking at things. Again, along my own sort of values of trying to tackle individual problems, OAs, working collaboratively with a customer and so forth, and ends up working on essentially media and entertainment products, in particular TV on demand, for a few years there. Again, very interested in technical side, very interested in delivery and management and so forth. So as I spend my time between technical architecture and management of team and teams and teams, going along doing that for a couple of years. And that was very interesting. Went from knowing nothing about TV on demand to knowing the technical side inside out pretty well within a couple of years. And then after that, I was not necessarily looking for somewhere else to go, but I always had an eye on a few companies, and McLaren was one of those. Having grown up sport mad, particularly motorsport, having grown up and having lived in the southeast in Surrey, so not too far from where McLaren are based, I kept my eye on what's going on there, and there was a job opportunity there for a technical project manager. I went to that. No role I was interested in at that time. Went to that and through just a couple of interviews, talked about the roles that are available, and ended up becoming a technical delivery manager, which resulted in later an engineering manager for McLaren Applied.
Wow, amazing! It's great. I mean, you know, you say McLaren Applied, and you're a very modest guy, but this has surely got to be one of the dream jobs for any kind of engineer, hasn't it? Really.
Yeah, so it is, and I think this is. I can remember my interview day. The first day I had a face-to-face interview there, sort of driving in past the big sign and up towards this amazing building. No other building, and going down through this sort of the walkway under the car park, and coming up this lift into the middle of the McLaren Technology Center. Wow. With the lake outside and all the sports cars to the side, and yeah, it was sort of as a child with my obsession, like I said, with sport and motorsport, and watching it, playing computer games and so forth. It was something special, and yeah, still now sort of going into the office and seeing the cars and the new ones and so forth does it's like a sort of a museum that not many people get to visit. It is very special. I guess this is where I guess my role and who I work for is a bit different from what. I guess I imagined as a child. I guess as a child, like a lot of people, I imagine I might be the one driving the car or whatever. And that hasn't quite worked out. Yeah. But I work for McLaren Applied, which is one of a few different parts of McLaren. So there's McLaren Group, which I sort of covers over a number of the different areas, and they've got McLaren Racing, which everyone knows is the Formula One team, but also involved in IndyCar racing as well. And then there's McLaren Automotive, which make all sort of the supercars and the F1 and the P1 and the 720S and so forth. And then there's McLaren Applied, which is where I work, which is essentially, it was an idea that sort of was thought up by Ron Dennis a good few decades ago around, okay, we do great things for Formula One, we do great things for automotive, particularly for people who can buy supercars, but what about the rest of the world? I want to take this and apply it to the rest of the world and to the benefit of everyone. And this is where I work. So McLaren Applied is trying to take the sort of the ideas or the things that we've found that can work in these sort of high tech, high speed industries and apply it to a wider domain. Interestingly, we do a lot of work for motorsport, so not just McLaren F1, but all the F1 teams, for all the IndyCar teams, the NASCAR teams, and so forth. But also McLaren Automotive, it has parts of our electronics and software in them, but also we've tried to take that and apply it to other domains, such as other bits of transport in particular, because that's quite transferable, but also non-transport domains as well. So it's a little bit different from what I imagined, but it's still very much in the same ethos and values as the rest of McLaren.
Yeah, it must be incredibly exciting working with such kind of cutting edge technology. And what immediately strikes me around this is, how do you stay current? How do you stay up to date with the new technology that you're working with? I mean, as it's so kind of ahead of its curve, I guess, and it is so cutting edge, where do you find resources for that? Where do you read about it? Do you listen to podcasts? Is there any podcasts around this kind of thing? Or what are your main go-to learning resources?
It's a problem for a lot of people, and yeah, there's a lot of, for example, startups with lots of ideas that we're not quite there, but we're quite often need to treat ourselves like that way. But you're right. There's lots of material online, whether it's podcasts or blogs and so forth. We've got relationships with a number of different parties that we can do, and from large ones such as AWS to smaller ones, where we're always trying to learn and keep from those, but also conferences and it's not just me, because my role, I'm trying to empower the team to be thinking about what's next, to find what's next, and solve problems. So it's as much the engineers who are close to the ground are the ones who need to be sort of think about how to do this. The idea is to bring the problem to the team, not the team to the problem. So we've got a set of teams. My team, data applications team, is all around the collection of data and applying insights to that data. So I work with product managers to bring problems from the market to the team, to work with product owners to define products we can be developing, and then the engineers have the remit to try and work out how to solve those problems, because that's the best you get out of engineers, by giving them difficult problems to solve rather than spoon feeding them ideas, because generally the collective idea of the engineering team will always come up with the best solution.
Absolutely. And also, so you're using F1 technology in the automotive world. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about that, and kind of, and what difficulties you've found with that, and what kind of things you're doing essentially.
Yeah, it's so the idea was, like I said, sort of coming from an F1 world, proving out things, coming from high value automotive space, and applying that to a wider domain, and sometimes it's actual bits we can take, sometimes it's the idea behind it, and the reason that second point it comes about is because essentially the use case between a Formula One race and, say, if you're then applying it to a car that we're driving around, is completely different. In that, for a Formula One car, you might need to be making sure you want to get a car to go around as quick as you can for 2 hours. If it then stops or fails afterwards, it doesn't matter, because you can build it back up, or you can reset it. But if you're selling a car that's going to be used for tens of thousands of miles each year between each service, then obviously you need to adjust your electronics, adjust your software on it. And in particular, I think the biggest thing that really resonates to me and how I think about it is that we have software, a piece of software called Atlas, that all Formula One teams use, but also used it, like I said, in other motor series, in America in particular, that takes all the data from the cars. So if you think about a Formula One car, you have potentially 300 sensors on a Formula One car, pulling out possibly about 4,000 different parameters off that car over a couple of hours. So you're talking sort of 3 to 4 gigabytes of data per car coming off each one, which we then put into our software, which if you ever watch a Formula One race and you see all the teams sat on the pit wall, the screens in front of them, that's the software I'm talking about. So here you have 30, 40 engineers looking at each car, looking at the telemetry coming through, working out what to do next, what to do in 10 laps time and so forth. Change that to you and me with our car taken to a garage, where one mechanic will see 10 cars per day, hundreds of cars per year, and you've got a slightly different problem in that. It's that whole thing of taking that and working out how do you make it cost effective without losing all the benefit of the collection of data, the highlighting of data. And yes, we do that for the in Formula One to make sure that all the engineers don't just look at the data, but they're alerted. We predict where things will change and they act on it. But we have to do it a lot more and with a lot cheaper hardware, for example, on sort of a mass market.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And, you know, I hear a lot about data and how people use data. And, you know, after speaking to a lot of people that work in data, it appears to me that data is very much in the eye of the beholder. Kind of, you can see whatever you want to see in data, essentially. And also, with the amount of data that you have, how do you find the... I was going to say right answer, but there's not always... How do you find the best answer in that data?
Yeah, and it's not always the best answer either. Yeah. It's valuable. It's a valuable answer. And I think this is sort of the journey that we have to go on, whether it's a development of a product or bringing a customer on board, is you're right. The first step is to actually get access to that data. So some companies have large amounts of data already collected. Some don't at all. Sometimes... You could go into a domain where there's data being collected by a vehicle, for example, but it's not going off the vehicle. So you have to work out how do you get that from the vehicle into the cloud or into a data center or something. And this is sort of the first challenge that my team has, and the products we develop is all around getting that data from an asset into a cloud or into someone else's data center so that we can actually gain access to it. And then once you got that, then the second thing is then, okay, how do you actually visualize that data? Because again, going back to Formula One, we got 4,000 parameters.
Wow.
That's the extreme case, but you need some way to at least start looking at that. And then once you start to be able to work out how you visualize it, and depending on how much data you got and the purpose you do, then there's a whole lot of exploration of like you said, try and work out what's valuable, what's interesting.
Yeah.
And this is where I guess I come back to, because the journey I've been on since as graduate coming in into my first job, and I told you about the learning of that place, trying not to do something big bang and an iterative approach, and this sort of comes back to my learning there and coming back to sort of agile way of working of small increments and so forth, is particularly when you're trying to discover what is valuable and what you can get out of data, is very much a journey where you have to look at the data, you have to be thinking about it with the customer, what the problem you're trying to solve, or the product you're trying to build, and iterate over that. And I think this is the journey I've been on in my career. Even my career is still relatively short compared to a lot of obviously a history of engineering. If you think about construction and so forth, but software engineering has gone for this agile path. And since I've started working, we've got the idea of a data scientist, and that role is really, really immature and growing and stuff. But the whole idea of that is, yes, you need time to think about what you can do and prove that there is value in that data and tie that back to sort of the coming back to the problem, give the problem to the data scientists, and they can work with the domain expert to find out what value can be found from that data.
It's really interesting because, you know, before I started doing these podcasts a few years ago, I had absolutely no idea how important data is. It just didn't occur to me at all, you know, before I started learning about it. And, you know, after I've spoken to a lot of people on this show, it's made me realize data is pretty much the center of everything, really. It's phenomenal. It's the most important thing in a lot of decisions. You know, it's amazing.
Yeah. I was going to say, I've worked with in the past some executives who've gone for that same realization themselves, where you talk about a proposition and we're talking about collecting data and talk about having to put sensors on that data and going from, okay, well, so the product is the sensor and the fact that we can get this data off, we're going, no, that's just a means to an end, and that's definitely valuable thing to do, but ultimately what is the value of getting data off if you can't do anything with it, sort of thing. So But yeah, it's the value in that data, and again, yeah, it's coming back to what problem you're trying to solve and try and find a fit for that.
You know, as I've been speaking to you, I've learned that it sounds like your team is highly collaborative, you know. And what I want to find out is how, you know, during COVID, when teams were physically separated and kind of isolated in a way, well, in fact, definitely isolated. Not, there's no inner way about it. But how did that affect the way that your teams worked?
Yeah, it's very interesting, probably, and it's another use case that I've never imagined having to do. But I essentially my role, I actually manage a team of teams, and all of those teams within that team are cross-functional teams, split across sort of software, hardware, data science, testing, product owners, and so forth. So you've got all these different engineers and looking at the problem in different ways. It was very difficult in terms of trying to work out the best way of working, but by that I mean best way of supporting the working. And interesting enough that one of the teams that I work with, it were already sort of semi-remote, in that some of the people were remote and some not. Another team was pretty much fully in the office and were completely used to that. And actually the team that was semi-remote actually found out that actually everyone working remote, they settled in pretty quickly and actually found it easier. That was very interesting to learn, because and looking back at it, it seems quite obvious now, but because the people that were working remote previously seemed to feel like they were missing out on conversations that were going on in the office. And they're getting different experiences. So I don't know if you've ever been in a meeting room where some of you are in there and some of you on a call, and the number of times people on the call ask you to repeat or whatever. And essentially, yeah, everyone's clearer. The conversations, the really useful conversations you can have at a desk with a couple of people, are really useful for those people. But if there's another person who happens to not be there because they work remote, then they missed out. So actually, we learned very quickly that although we had to solve those problems, it actually meant that everyone was trying to solve the same problems, and we could focus on it. But I think the biggest things from me was just taking time to adjust to it, allowing people time to adjust to it, and talk about what are the things that we want to do, what are the things we found useful. And adjusting, for example, face-to-face communication was very useful. And I always thought face-to-face meant like physical face-to-face, but actually, as you and I are now, this is pretty good. You can see expressions. You can tell a lot easier even like this than voice calls, and certainly
absolutely
emails.
Yeah.
So you start to put in place like that. I think there's also spending more time with individuals, and because you can learn so much more and then apply it to your other meetings, is very useful. But yeah, I think the team that were already half remote actually settled in, and strangely enough, more recently, where we started to talk about potentially we could be going back in. Obviously, guidelines, regulations have changed slightly, and that we can work in the office if we want to, and so forth. There's not been a rush to get back in. So saying, well, actually, we found a way of working that suits us, and I think that's one of the biggest things. It's something that suits the team.
Yeah, and it'll be different with every business and every team within every business. They'll have their own way that works best. I mean, I've spoken to some businesses where everyone's desperate to get back into the office, you know, and some people who aren't really bothered about going into the office at all. So it's kind of finding that balance and seeing where that dust settles over a period of time. It's really interesting. And also, you mentioned you lead a team of teams. Now, what I'm finding interesting about this is that I can't imagine, and I know there's a lot of books about leadership and how to lead a team, but then how do you learn about even higher level management than that? So you're leading a team of teams. I imagine most of this would be kind of through experience, I guess, or is there resources out there that you can?
Yes, yeah, so that there is, and this is where I guess you move from, I guess, sort of management through to sort of leadership and scaling. There's some very well documented ways of scaling. So for example, there's an agile methodology called SAFe, which is all about scaling. From a single scrum team to multiple scrum teams and so forth. But I think again that has is quite prescriptive and overly prescriptive in my view. My view of having the values of agile and agility is doing the right thing in the right circumstance. So you need to take readings and learnings of frameworks like that, as well as experience, as well as again going on courses with other people that you can discuss your ideas. And I guess the places that I've learned most is actually with the people I work with, and I've been lucky to work with a lot of smart people, a lot of people with experience, and I guess this is where, in particular, when I moved to consultancy, I was brought me out of the shell, and that there were so many people that were brought together from different places that you get to experience. You talk to them about, okay, how could we handle this, and you talk about how you had different experiences in a similar way and which ones didn't go work so well or did work so well. And it, again, sort of the collective mind of trying to work out the thing, it can be difficult having to bite your tongue sometimes and go, no, I think that, but you need to try things and you learn yourself as well as the team learns what to do. But yeah, it's definitely, there is different ideas, different ways and prescriptive ways to scale teams. But yeah, I think you have to be agile. You have to look at what's right and right in the same context and try and shape it. And as you would like of a small team, regularly review how the team's going. So in a single team, we quite often have like retrospectives every couple of weeks where we say what things are going well and not going well. Do we want to shape our processes? Is there anything we suggest with the customer? Also review it regularly on a wider aspect. So I have a sort of a leadership team. So people representing those teams, the sort of the leaders from those, work with those, see how we can work better across the teams. Sometimes the teams can come a bit isolated and go, right, is that because we're working on separate things, or actually should we bring them back together for certain ways? Should we cut it and so forth? The fact we've got essentially three cross-functional teams, there are some functions that work across them. So how do we make sure that those teams also, well, functions work together and stuff. So, and again, it's trying to pull the experience from all the teams, everything they hear from all their engineers, to pull together the problems we need to solve and continuously improve the team. And because whenever you think you've got something sorted, something else to come along.
Yep.
COVID was one thing, yeah. But that was an extreme example. But yeah, it was always a new customer, a new product, or a new idea, or a new engineer, or something that comes along, and you have to always constantly, there's always constant room for improvement.
Mm. I think a huge part of, you know, leadership and, you know, especially high level leadership, although I've never been a leader myself, so this is quite funny for me to even say this, but I'd say a lot of it through what you were saying is communication, would you say?
Yes, definitely. There's another thing, I guess, with COVID and working from home is come clear, and by communication, it isn't always talking. I think listening, and I found this particularly when people did start working from home, and certainly the people in the team that weren't so used to working from home previously, I spent an awful lot of time listening.
Yeah.
And whether that's a one-to-one with the team, and I sort of increased the number of one-to-ones I had with people because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't missing the little nuanced things I'd seen in the office, or whether it's in a larger meeting with more people, the need to focus is very important. I'm sure you've seen it. You're in meetings and there are other people there whilst they're doing the tapping away and doing something else. And I'd be lying if I said I haven't done that myself sometimes. But I try to really listen and listen intently, and take everything you can out of those, because there's no point in being in a meeting, particularly yeah. one where you're on a headset remote from each other and so forth, if you're not paying attention, getting something out of it.
Mm.
And I think that's it's important to listen, and that helps you then communicate, pick up things, help you communicate back, and make sure that you're fully engaged. If you're not engaged, then and there's a reason that you're not engaged, that you don't need to be there, then say you don't need to be there. Go and then at least everyone knows you're not there, and then they can follow up with you afterwards. But if you're there, make sure you're listening, make sure you're communicating, and yeah, it's real massive, even more important in a remote workforce.
And I think actually what you were mentioning there, like listening, is so overlooked in leadership. You know, we talk about leadership a lot on the podcast, and what comes up in these recordings a lot is how important empathy is, mm-hmm. Which it is. It's hugely important. It's probably one of the most important aspects of leadership, I'd say. But what often gets overlooked is listening, and I found that mm-hmm. really, really interesting.
No, I agree, because ultimately, you end up being sympathetic as opposed to empathetic if you're not listening and you're not actually putting yourself in there, and yeah, it's completely there, and I think it's, if you can listen and think about it and think about the situation that people are going through, not only can you help them then, but also then when you come to another meeting, say for example, going back to sort of a retrospective, you're in a retrospective later that week or the week after, and that person you've had that one-to-one with says something, and you'll think about, actually, when that sounds similar or related to the point they said earlier, you can help bridge the explanation of that gap, because other people won't necessarily know where this has come from, and yeah, if you're not listening, you're not thinking about it when someone talks, it can be missed, and I think this is something that talking about sort of what sort of how we can learn to be a leader, and I have been on courses, and I continue going on courses where it talks about communicating and so forth, and one of the things that that came out of there very much was about when someone's talking to you, take your time to listen to what they're talking about. It doesn't matter if you have to wait a few seconds until after they finish to think about what they're saying, because it's too easy sometimes to hear half a sentence and then start thinking about what your response is and miss the second half. And at that point there, you're not really giving the value or not answering the question. So yeah, take your time, listen. A pause is not a bad thing for you to take your time to think about what the full question was and then come up with your answer. You don't have to be a TV presenter where you're getting 101 exactly. questions quickly. Just it's more valuable to actually have a good conversation, and that starts with listening to what the actual question is.
Yeah, exactly. Just using your advice here. And also, you know, see, there's more than just this part of your role. I mean, I guess what we're talking about now is how you look after those teams and those teams of teams. And, you know, there's probably, I mean, imagine there's many parts to your role, but there's another part which I'm really interested in, which is, you know, having to look, as we mentioned, it's a very cutting edge business and industry that you're working in. So how do you go from, you know, the day-to-day kind of looking after those teams and teams of teams, how do you go from looking down within the business, making sure things are running properly, and having those leadership meetings and thinking about leadership, and also having to look kind of out and ahead of the business for new technologies and new ways of working and looking for the future of the business, essentially. I guess the question is, how do you balance that? without losing sight of the other, if that makes sense. Very long-winded way to ask that question, but
no, I completely make sense. And yeah, it is a really, really challenging task to do. And I think this is where I try to set myself up with the best support I can. And essentially, it's a lot of things there. So work closely with product managers and product owners who are talking with customers, who are testing things from a value point of view to try and work out what the problems we can solve, what's the next thing from a valuable point of view there. But then couple that with the technical expertise and I have people in my team who are particularly focused on supporting those product managers in terms of going to those meetings and thinking about, okay, is that something that's related to the technology we're working on, or the technical know-how we can have as a team, but also makes them spark of other ideas that they might be able to feedback in. But at the same time, sort of coming back again to the sort of the collective mind of the team, it's important that it's not just a couple of people doing that. And that's where it's a real hard balancing act when you've got a roadmap or you've got a customer deliverable to do, but you have to try and somehow free up others in your team to have an idea of those. And this is where, through articulation of product roadmaps and technology roadmaps, originating from these people who are close to the front. So I support those and do sort of the first level of validation on behalf of the team of that, yes, that sounds like a good idea or something related to us, or yes, we could possibly solve that problem sort of thing. But getting others in the team involved in that, and that's through sort of regular roadmap reviews, but also dedicating time outside of current deliverables. And that could be by saying sometimes it might be a few hours a week on say on a Friday afternoon to do an experiment, or it may be that we in between product iterations we say, right, okay, we can have an innovation week where we've got this idea that if we combine technology A and technology B, we can make technology C, for example, and a few things on that, and in particular demonstrating how we can get telemetry data from vehicles in different ways or join it in ways to show working relationships between that data and so forth. And that basically give the team time to experiment and take all the things that I've read and point towards, but more like they've read in their blogs or the forums or the conferences they're going to just try something out. And that's really important because ultimately everyone's got different ideas, and giving everyone time and me supporting them in that way will generate the best ideas. And it's sort of a big ongoing circle of how do you keep innovating whilst delivering, which is a very tricky thing to do. And no matter how much you grow, there's more innovating, more doing
exactly.
to do.
Exactly. And I guess a lot of that is kind of innovation is kind of helping your teams aware that it's okay to fail in a way. Is that kind of the culture that you kind of breed at McLaren?
Yes, definitely you have to. And there is there's quite a well-known book about startups called Lean Startup, and that talks all about fail fast and this whole thing. You need to make sure that it's not the failing that you're succeeding, it's the learning from that failure that's the success. And that is a very, again, it's a very difficult balancing act to do when you've got essentially a business wanting to make money and so forth. But ultimately, you're not gonna make money, you're not gonna grow the business if you spend a year, 2 years building something which doesn't work. And this sort of comes back to the Big Bang approach of software development that I studied a lot at college and university. I thankfully haven't had too much experience in my career in that. Yeah, if you start off with this idea of set of requirements and work your way through building it, testing it, and then give it to a customer months or years later, it takes you that long before you realize actually what you've done is actually useful or not. The shorter you can take that cycle down to, the quicker you're going to learn. And yeah, it doesn't matter if you learn that, that's not valuable. So it sort of comes back to data in particular, like we talked at the beginning. That's the only way you learn what is valuable in data is by iterating as quick as you can, seeing if it's valuable or not. And interestingly, one of the biggest challenges I have with my team is reminding them that it's not always the most technically complex or interesting answer that's the most valuable to the customer. Sometimes the quicker you can get to an answer, the quicker you'll test how close are you to the good enough answer, then the better answer, then the best answer. And yeah, going through those iterations, you can quickly iterate through understanding what is valuable and then hopefully getting to a product or a solution that both the customer finds valuable and the team finds interesting to deliver.
Mm. Yeah, and I guess failing fast isn't just useful in technologies. It's kind of useful in every single industry, really. And I think like the term failure is quite harsh, really. And I think it should just be called, I don't know, a learning rather than a failure. If some, you know, because it isn't, it's yes. not, it's not fail, you're not failed, it's just not worked out. I just think failure is such a harsh word for what it is.
Yep, no, I agree, and learning fast would be a far, far better answer. But you're right, it applies to everything, because I guess if you think about a completely different use case outside the world of work. If you say you're going on holiday and you've never been on a cruise before, and you go, oh, I'd love to go on that cruise. If you book around the world cruise for a whole year, then you go up to it, second day out, you realize, hang on, boat's not for you. that's basically what we're trying to do. And so what would you do in that case? Okay, maybe you go out for a day trip on a boat and stuff. And at that point there, you go, yeah, that's not for me, this boat sort of a holiday, then you know, okay, maybe next time I'll go and stay in a hotel in the middle of a city. It's that whole thing.
Exactly, right.
You've come to that conclusion much quicker, much cheaper, and that's essentially what we're trying to do in a sort of a data world with software and analytics.
Yeah, exactly. How do you instill that culture in your teams then? How do you make them aware that it's okay to fail, essentially?
Some people it's easier than others in that, but I think it is all, like we said, it's all about the learner. I think it's one of the things that no matter what domain you're working in, if you're working with an agile team where you've got very short-term goals, you have to be 100% aligned on what you're trying to achieve. And in particular, there's this idea of defining a definition of done. So how do you know you're done? So some people might think, okay, if we're building, for example, a website, a developer might think, I'm done once I've finished my code changes and checked in. But that doesn't actually result in a web page working. So the definition of done in someone else's view might be actually is developed, it's been tested, and it's deployed and live. So it's all these things here. So first of all, you have to agree what that little definition of done is for each of your bits. And through that, you can have that conversation around, okay, particularly when you're doing an exploratory part where you don't know if it's going to work or not. So whether you're looking at trying to find some data that might be valuable, or you don't know if this technology is appropriate, in your definition of done, you can say, right, our definition of done is when we've, for example, learned whether this will work, or we've learned that this will not work, but it's more likely the case, or we've captured all the parameters that could possibly be of interest to the customer and they confirmed yes or no. You haven't solved that problem, but at least you can do it, and you can all agree that's a learning point, and that's got to be your goal for the next week or the next 2 weeks. And then once you get to that point, you can have a discussion about, okay, are we on the right path? Yes, no. If you are, we can iterate and progress to the next sort of logical step, which you might have pre-planned, or if no, then you've learned something and you either have to pivot, or you have to try something else, or you might try the same thing but in a slightly different way. And it's through like having conversations like that on a daily and a weekly and a fortnightly basis that sort of reinforces that message that that, yeah, we might have a vision of where we're hoping to go, but you can't really tell, particularly at the very early stages of exploration and discovery. You need a few iterations of probably failure before you realize actually this is A, achievable, and B, valuable.
But yeah, we could literally talk about this for hours, James. We really could. But before we go, I mean, I'd love to ask you your thoughts on the future of the your thoughts on the future of the automotive world. And you know, we hear a lot of these things coming from the likes of Elon Musk and people like that and these big industry leaders. But where can you see the world of the automotive space? Keep getting that wrong.
It's interesting because there's the big thing that's going on at the moment around obviously combustion engines versus electric and so forth. And I think there's still more to play out on that. And in McLaren Applied, we're currently involved in a lot of those discussions supporting those. So for example, the current generation 2 batteries for Formula E, which the electric series are McLaren Applied batteries and so forth. So we're looking at areas there. I think a lot of it's now focused on the control units and the inverters that we supplied to the Ferris series, as well as the data and so forth. So there's stuff on there, and I won't wade into that because that's a great big debate. But I think the obvious trend is the fact that, there is, come back to where sits in my team's sort of remit, is sort of the data again, and everything that, yeah, if you look at the Tesla and the automated car, although it's whether it's automated or semi-automated depends on which report you read and so forth, but all that's driven on the data coming off, then be able to obviously run analytics, make it safe choices and so forth. And I think that's ultimately where we're going, is the smart car with the smart city and so forth. There's obviously a lot of safety concerns around that, and that's where you go from sort of, again, if you look at Formula One, we've got all that data off, and we make we have engineers in the loop and drivers in the loop who make the decision. I think that's the first step to bring that to the wider automotive industry and other forms of transport, whether that's trains or boats or trucks. And that's the thing that we're immediately able to do and working with, and that's the kind of projects we're on now, where we're able to take data and suggest improvements for the drivers of those vehicles or the maintainers of those vehicles to make it cheaper, quicker, maintain longer and so forth. But then the longer term goal is to make those more automated. So you got self-driven trucks and trains, particularly over in Australia, the massive trains there, the amount because of them going for miles without seeing anything, it's seen, obviously there's less choices to make. The difference being the payloads, and they're basically the trains are miles long. They've got such big payloads and sort of thing, obviously if anything does go wrong there, then it's a pretty big thing. But yeah, that's ultimately where I see getting to, and you see things like Robo Race, where they're already trying automated AI racing and stuff, and it's a few years off because of the safety concerns and things there, but we're already on that path. We're already at a point where you have to plug in your USB pen into a car to read off the readings, whereas mechanics 20, 30 years ago would never have had to be able to do that. And be sort of driver in the loop, recommendations and guidance and stuff. Then ultimately it will be bringing the AI in to bring it all into a smart city and smart cars.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. It really is, James. And I'm fully aware that I've kept you here for quite a substantial amount of time now.
Okay.
It's such a shame because I could literally sit here and chat to you all evening. I really could. But yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to, you know, come on the show and have a chat to me. So yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
No problem. It's been my pleasure to talk again.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform.